Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Jeremy Cliff, International Editor in Berlin.
I'm Emily Tamkin, Senior Editor US in Washington, D.C.
I'm Ido Vok, Europe Correspondent in Berlin.
It's Thursday, the 27th of January. You're listening to World Review from The New Statesman, a twice-weekly international news podcast. Every Thursday, we come together to unpack some of the most significant stories in world affairs. And every Monday, we interview a guest for their unique perspective and expertise. This week, we discuss Jeremy's trip to Kiev and how he found the mood on the ground as Russian forces continue to amass on the Ukrainian border.
Our actions over the past week have sharpened the choice facing Russia now. We've laid out a diplomatic path. We've lined up steep consequences should Russia choose further aggression. It remains up to Russia to decide how to respond. We're ready either way.
We'll talk about why I found Ukrainians surprisingly sanguine about the apparent threat of invasion.
Then, a listener question on the role of energy politics in the crisis.
Thank you for joining us. Let's begin. All right, before we actually begin, we want to remind you about our special offer for podcast listeners. Go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer and subscribe to The New Statesman in digital, print, or both for as little as £1 a week for the first 12 weeks in the UK. That's just €1 a week in Europe and just $2 a week in the rest of the world. Just head to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. With that, Jeremy, you were in Kiev in Ukraine. What were your main impressions from your trip?
I think the most striking thing, given the backdrop and having followed the ongoing concerns about what the 127,000 Russian troops massed around Ukraine's borders are meant to do, is just how much ordinary life is continuing in the Ukrainian capital. People are not panic buying. There are no queues at the banks. People are going about their everyday lives. And in some ways, that shouldn't surprise us because Ukraine has been at war for 8 years. You know, it was in 2014 that Russia occupied parts of the Donbass and annexed Crimea. And so I think Ukrainians have got used to war as a sort of background brooding presence. But I think this calm is also reflected in Ukrainians' leadership and in its sort of media and civil society class. And I think talking to officials, journalists, civil society figures, politicians, I was struck at how unconvinced they were that Russia was planning anything imminent or enormous in terms of military action. They do think that there is a risk that Russia will send in troops. There is a risk even of a full-scale invasion. But I think they don't consider that risk as great as some of the international coverage and some international governments would lead us to believe.
There was some discussion this past week as to whether or not there was different, maybe international versus internal messaging in Ukraine. Because on the one hand, you had Ukrainian officials openly upset that, for example, American diplomats were reportedly leaving Kiev. But on the other hand, you have more lethal aid being sent to Ukraine and support requested for Ukraine from the wider, quote unquote, Western world. Mm. Do you think it's a matter of Ukrainian authorities positioning themselves differently for the world versus for Ukrainians? Or is it just that, you know, when you're out of it, you read the headlines and you see, oh my goodness, another however many thousand troops and you, you know, and Putin said this and Biden said this and Zelensky said this. And so it's just different when you're actually there.
I think it's a bit of both. The announcement that the US was withdrawing some non-essential staff and diplomatic families along with the UK came while I was in Kyiv. And the people I spoke to were uniformly dismissive of that move and in some cases actively irritated by it. I think they felt that it was excessive, it was premature, and that it risked creating panic among the Ukrainian population and indeed among investors. There's a great concern that you'll have an outflow of capital from the country that could actually cause a financial crisis, you know, park the talk about a military crisis. And I think that is partly because Ukraine's leaders don't want to panic people. President Zelensky last week, shortly before I arrived, had given an address in which he said, we don't need to panic. There's no imminent prospect of a war. Continue with your daily lives. The last thing the Ukrainian government needs with this military threat is people rushing to the banks or the shops or fleeing to the countryside or whatever. I also think it reflects the views of Ukraine's leadership. You know, talk to people both on and off the record, as I did, and they say, look, Putin is trying to stir things up. He's trying to put pressure on Ukraine, and he's trying to pressure the US, NATO, the EU to make concessions, and in turn to put pressure on Ukraine to agree to those concessions. He wants to be in the spotlight. He wants to be respected. He wants to negotiate eye to eye with the US. It's a lot about prestige. And so, some even think that the US might be kind of, you know, exaggerating the threat in order to get Ukraine to the table, to make certain concessions, and frankly, get the issue out of the way. You know, they recognize that Joe Biden wants to focus on the contest with China. And they think that talking all of this up is a way to push Ukraine to make concessions, particularly about the autonomy granted to the occupied parts of Donbass, for example, or the prospects of Ukraine's joining NATO anytime in the near to medium term. And so I think there is a sincerity about this calmness and about this doubt about whether Russia would unleash a full-scale invasion. I mean, pretty much everyone I spoke to said that Putin would have to be completely crazy to attempt that, not least because the Ukrainian population is ready to resist that, and any sort of full invasion of the country would end up mired in urban warfare. There would be resistance, there would be partisan reprisals. So there is just a view that he's not that crazy and that he's getting a lot of what he wants already.
So what do people in Ukraine think Putin is up to? What if he's not going to go for a full-scale invasion, and in their view, the preparations that we're seeing at the moment are not for a full-scale invasion, which incidentally is kind of where I've been for a while. I agree with you, and I think I agree with the kind of the analysts who in general seem to know what they're talking about, who say that if it's possible to at all predict what is going to happen, it's probably more likely to be a kind of lightning offensive intended to destabilize Ukraine and to degrade its military and to kind of teach them a lesson than it is to be a sustained occupation, which, as you say, would be very costly and probably inside Russia close to a potentially regime-ending event in terms of the internal destabilization it would cause within Russia. What do the Ukrainians think the Russians are up to then?
First of all, they don't think that action is imminent in the way that some of the international coverage would make you think. And that's partly based on assessments of the Russian troop readiness, the fact that the forces massed on the country's borders do not look ready to move in a big way. This is not to say that Ukrainian leaders and politicians and so forth don't think Russia will act militarily. But as you say, the scenarios they tend to talk about are generally more surgical or more limited. So possibly some sort of action in Donbass in order to consolidate effective Russian control, especially around Luhansk, Donetsk, possibly Kharkiv. Possibly, as you say, a very fast raid into wider Ukrainian territory, possibly modeled on the 2008 war with Georgia, with a maximalist scenario that one or two people put to me was a blockade of Kyiv, but one that would be intended to be quick and to topple the Ukrainian government rather than any long-term occupation. And then, of course, there's the prospect of military intervention that doesn't involve quote-unquote boots on the ground. So airstrikes on strategic targets and perhaps cyber warfare. And we've already seen cyber attacks on the Ukrainian state in the last weeks, almost certainly deriving from Russia. And so the view is that, first of all, we shouldn't necessarily expect anything in the immediate future. And secondly, if it does come, it will be probably more limited than the sort of full-scale invasion that some people have been talking about.
Obviously, you were just in Ukraine, but now you're back in Germany. And I think one of the interesting kind of subplots of this has been that on the one side, you have the Americans and the British who are kind of quite stridently warning that an invasion is imminent and they think it could come at any time. the way they see that the troop buildups is really kind of preparations for military action that is imminent and, you know, could happen whenever and possibly with very little notice. And then on the other hand, you have the French and Germans who are looking at the same troop movements who are, they're not relaxed about it, but they say that Russia hasn't got all the elements in place. If it really was preparing to for a full-scale invasion, it hasn't got all the elements in place. And they talk about things like fuel supplies, which apparently they don't see as being in place, which are obviously fairly essential were Russia to move in. And as you've repeatedly hinted, the Ukrainians are kind of more on the latter camp in that, at least in their public pronouncements, they don't think an invasion is coming tomorrow now, irrespective of who might be right and who might be wrong. What do you kind of attribute this difference in views to? And obviously it also creates differences in terms of the policies that are advocated, because the British and the Americans are at the moment the ones who are the most hawkish, who are giving the most assistance to Ukraine, because apparently it seems to be that they think that they are the ones who think an invasion is most likely, and the French and the Germans are a little bit more reticent, the Germans especially, and they've had a lot of coverage recently, because they think an invasion is probably less imminent. So what do you put that down to?
Yeah, one of the striking things about the sort of the views I heard from people in Kyiv was that there is a lot of gratitude towards the likes of the UK, the US, the Baltics, Czech Republic, for the military support that's been provided. Just because the Ukrainian establishment is somewhat more sanguine about the threat from Russia does not mean that they're not extremely grateful. In fact, they would like to see more arms. They would like more in terms of anti-aircraft arms. They want more in terms of training, in terms of anti-tank weapons. So they welcome that very much. And Germany's reticence in particular has been noticed and has angered many. Some of the responses I got when I asked about Germany's stance in this all were not fit to go into my article because they were unprintable. And I think, by the way, particularly not just Germany refusing to export arms directly, but Germany intervening to block other NATO members from exporting arms, specifically the Baltics. That in particular makes people cross. And yet, despite that, I think those that I spoke to, and I think I spoke to a reasonable cross-section of opinion in the Ukrainian establishment, were probably closer to the French and German view, as you say, on the chances of imminent warfare. And I think there are various possible explanations. I'm not in a position to say which is absolutely correct. I do think perhaps the reality of dealing with the war day-to-day, as I've said over the past years, has kind of... it feels like less of a sudden thing to Ukrainians who've had to come to terms with it. I think they, as you say, have believed that the way Russia's set up around Ukraine's borders is not, you know, does not put it in a position to move immediately. And as you say, defense analysts do seem to agree with that. There is a theory doing the rounds, and it is just a theory that the US might have, and this was put to me a couple of times, perhaps the US has intelligence that it's not fully sharing, at least not publicly, or indeed potentially not even with the Ukrainian government, that makes it think that something is more imminent than what the facts would seem to say. That's just pure speculation. A couple of people said, well, perhaps they just know something that they're not telling us.
Well, there was one piece of speculation that was made public from the UK side, which was the UK came out and said, we have reason to believe that Russia may be trying to install a pro-Kremlin leader of Ukraine. Since that news broke while you were there, I'm curious as to whether there were any thoughts on that.
Yes, while I was there, the UK declassified intelligence that Russia was contemplating a plan that would see it topple the Ukrainian government and impose a pro-Kremlin replacement. And the name Yevhen Morayev was mentioned. He is a pro-Russian Ukrainian politician. And this caused quite a furore internationally, the idea that Russia might attempt to do that. It's not entirely non-credible. It's well known that Putin would like to have a sort of Lukashenko-style patsy in Kyiv who would turn the country back from its progress towards the West and its kind of pivot towards the West over the last decade. But the idea that someone like Morayev might sort of be slotted into place in Kyiv was treated with nothing short of ridicule, to be honest. It was repeatedly noted that the Ukrainian population has turned quite drastically against Russia in the last years because of the events of 2014, because of the occupation, because of the bullying, And so the idea that it would sort of simply tolerate some Kremlin puppet being imposed was seen as non-credible. And the idea of Muraev specifically, who was, as I said, the individual cited in this intelligence, might be in a position to run the country with any sort of settled consent behind him was seen as ridiculous as well. I mean, this man is, I think he's on about 6% in the polls of who people want as the country's next president. He has himself denied it, although I suppose he would. But that was not seen as a credible scenario, I have to say. But Emily, just sitting in Washington, I mean, the US administration has been very willing to push the idea that Putin could act anytime. And I suppose that is understandable. They do want to work on the basis of the worst case scenario. Biden has said he thinks Putin would move in. His spokeswoman has said that the action could come at any point. How settled a consensus do you think that is within the US political establishment? Is it widely accepted that Putin will go for a fairly maximalist course here, or are the views that it could take longer or take a different form?
I was kind of surprised that Biden said that publicly. Perhaps I should not have been surprised given that it's Biden, but just because it seems to leave the Russian side so little room to quietly pull back from this, although maybe there's little room already. You know, it's interesting. So much has stayed in the United States since Trump, of Trumpism. But I think, at least in Washington, I think this is probably different in the country more broadly, but in Washington, there still is this bipartisan consensus that Russia is a threat, that the United States needs to sort of expect the worst from Russia and act accordingly. Now, that doesn't mean that Republicans are supportive of Biden on this. And in fact, I think many figures on the Hill, Ted Cruz comes to mind, have been openly critical of Biden for his handling of this crisis. But I think while in the wider United States, there may be some question as to, well, wait a minute, why are you, particularly on the Tucker Carlson right and the progressive left, questions to, you know, why are we spending money on Ukraine? You know, we don't have healthcare, or the Tucker version is like, why is Russia bad but Ukraine is good? Which is a framing that we could do not have time for on this podcast. But since your question was specific to Washington, the short answer is yes. I think the view in Washington is that Putin and Russia are a threat. We, the United States, need to act accordingly.
Yes. One thing I'd add to this in terms of how other states are responding to the situation is that, and I think that we don't talk about very much, but was really emphasized in the conversations I had in Kyiv, was that Ukraine doesn't just need military support and arms to deter Russia, although it does need that. But it also needs other forms of support. So financial support is one of them. There's a real concern that Ukraine could have a crisis of government borrowing. So it's looking for international partners to underwrite its bonds. And the other thing is to prepare the possibility of humanitarian support. As I said, the idea that Putin would undertake a full-scale invasion is considered very unlikely, but some sort of military action does certainly seem to be on the radar as a serious possibility. And the question is, how would the West react if, say, even in the event of a kind of a short and rapid raid into Ukrainian territory, you have people fleeing major Ukrainian cities, possibly to the border with Poland, possibly to parts of the west of the country that are less likely to be affected. So I think in terms of all of these discussions taking place in capitals like Washington and London and Berlin and Paris, it's a message that I would take back from Ukraine itself was, yes, arms matter, but also other forms of support matter too. Wherever you are in the world,
if you're interested in global affairs,
you can subscribe to The New Statesman in digital, in print, or both from as little as £1 a week. That's 12 weeks for just £12.
That's €1 a week in Europe and just $2 a week in America.
Just go to www.newstatesman.com/podcast offer.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And with that, it's time to move to a section that we like to call
You Ask Us.
You Ask Us. Oh, Jeremy, we did a great job. This question comes to us from Fahim via email. Do you think Germany's phase out of nuclear energy in the 2010s was a mistake for them in terms of their foreign policy when it comes to Russia, as they are now more reliant on energy sources such as natural gas from Russia? Ido, you recently wrote a piece on this, so why don't you take the first step?
Sure. So over the past roughly decade, many European countries have started phasing out coal because coal is a very polluting fuel. It's the most polluting fossil fuel. And so many European countries, not all of them, but many of them, including Germany, have started phasing out its use as they try to decarbonize their energy production and energy supply. At the same time, Germany has also been phasing out its nuclear program, particularly after the 2011 Fukushima disaster, when Angela Merkel took the decision to eventually decommission all of Germany's nuclear power plants. I think half of them went offline at the beginning of this year, so it's very recent. And so the share of energy produced by nuclear power in Germany has been decreasing. And so there is a shortfall to be made up for because the use of coal and nuclear has been decreasing in Germany, but not only in Germany. You can find similar trends in many other European countries. And part of the shortfall has been made up by renewables, so things like wind and solar, but not all of it has. And so many countries have continued to rely on natural gas, which has not been phased out to the same extent, and in some cases has the use of which has increased, because natural gas is what many energy experts call a bridge fuel, because it's one of the cleaner fossil fuels. And so you can kind of use it as you're transitioning from very dirty fossil fuels, which is coal, to zero carbon, which is renewables. And so, for example, in Germany, the amount of energy generated by natural gas increased by about 10% between 2010 and 2020, even as the amount of energy generated by nuclear and coal went down significantly. So all that to say that basically many European countries have continued to rely on natural gas, including but not only Germany, over the past decade or so, and they get very much of their gas from Russia. So imports of Russian gas have increased over the past decade, and they increased quite a lot, in fact, since 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea and invaded Ukraine for the first and, we hope, last time. So they were at about 115 billion cubic meters in 2014, and they increased to 180 billion cubic meters in 2019 for the EU27. So we're now seeing the costs of this policy, which means that Europe is reliant on energy supplies from a geopolitical rival, and it gives Europe a really quite significant sort of Achilles heel in terms of how it wants to respond to Russia. And because if Russia were to turn off the taps, there's already a global supply crunch. There are already record prices. Households are facing increased prices, including for gas, but not only for gas, a general cost of living squeeze. And so it's a certainty that this is part of the Kremlin's calculation, because it thinks that Europe will be less able to take sanctions against Russia in response to a military incursion. And so we've had reports this week that the US is talking to, for example, Gulf countries to attempt to make up the shortfall if Russia were to turn off the taps. But that's a really kind of, it's a really big big ask. I'm not in a position to say whether it's impossible or not, but it would be, you know, billions and billions of cubic meters of gas, which would have to be produced and then shipped to the EU at very, very short notice if we want to avoid the, you know, the lights going out in the EU. So it really is a kind of a very big vulnerability for Europe.
I would just quickly note two things. The first is that over the past however many years that Nord Stream 2 has been debated between the United States and specifically Germany, the American argument has been you cannot disentangle geopolitics from energy and economics. And Germany had insisted these are separate, right? This has nothing to do with geopolitics. This is a pipeline. And I think that we are seeing now that there were perhaps some flaws with that line of thinking. The other thing that I would just very quickly note is that there have been some who have said, well, the US can just provide LNG or liquefied natural gas to Europe and that will make up the shortfall. And, you know, that could make up some of the shortfall. But the reality is that, as most experts have pointed out, there just isn't enough, right? There just isn't enough LNG that we can get to Europe to make up the difference.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I think it's very clear that the Merkel government's de facto choice of gas over nuclear as its transitional power source on the road to decarbonization will probably be regarded as its biggest historical mistake. And, you know, the old chestnut in German politics that gas supplies are not political, they're just economic, has been disproven yet again in the past days. You know, we saw yesterday as we record this, the Russian government said, if you try and cut us off from the SWIFT international payment system, which is being discussed as a possible response to a Russian attack on Ukraine, then we'll turn off the gas. So the idea that this is not political has just been proven to be such utter nonsense. And it just goes to show the folly of policies like the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. But I'd like to just quickly, before we end, just add a final thought, because going back to our main discussion, because although I was very struck by how calm Ukrainians are about things, how pragmatic they are, I wouldn't want listeners to go away thinking that this is not an extraordinary situation and a very dangerous situation. I think Ukrainians are being admirably measured in response to it. They're not succumbing to panic, which would be the worst thing. But I mean, one of the things that will stay with me from that trip is just the fact that people are having to prepare for the worst case scenario, even if they don't think that's particularly likely. You know, the city council last year published a map of Cold War era bomb shelters. People are making plans for, you know, packing a bag, as they call it, a go bag, with things like batteries and documents and money in case they need to flee the city. One person I spoke to who didn't think a full invasion was very likely at all said that he nonetheless looked at maps of the city to see how he could get out through the back streets if the roads were jammed up in some sort of panic moment. And, you know, I spoke to a couple of parents who said that they'd been, you know, they'd had to talk to their children about what to do if suddenly, you know, if the electricity all goes off or if there are explosions, what to do. And so even if I think it would be a mistake to get carried away with some of the kind of the most nightmarish scenarios, it is still absolutely wild to be in a major European city and seeing those sort of conversations and those sorts of preparations taking place. So I think that, you know, if there's one thing I take away from that trip, it's yes, we the West need to be measured and not to rush to assumptions about what's going to happen. But this is we are facing the possibility of a very serious attack on the very concept of national self-determination, national sovereignty, and peace in Europe. And that is quite remarkable. So I'd leave us all with that thought as a qualification to what I found about Ukrainians being calmer than we might expect.
And on that sobering note, thanks to everyone who sent in your questions. You can send yours in to podcasts@newstatesman.co.uk or by tweeting at us.
That's all the time we have for today. Join us next Monday for an interview with Congressman Ro Khanna on Biden's domestic agenda, divisions within the Democratic Party, and Representative Khanna's new book.
If you've enjoyed this episode of World Review, please like, subscribe, rate us, leave a review, and tell your friends.
Our producer has been Mae Robson. Thank you for listening, and until next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.